Introducing Rav Moshe Aberman at a snowy Thursday morning in Efrat at 9:05, as we zip along with Zoom with Efrat and Eshkolo. Rav Aberman will continue on the literature of the Torah Shabbat Path.
Right. And we will continue with the Achronic period. We have a little bit to close up on the commentaries on the Tanakh, and then we will move on to other discussions. But in any event, we will be discussing today the Achronic period. We saw previously that the appearance of the Before movement, together with the Enlightenment movement, challenged the classic learning of Tanakh and brought about a situation where there were some of the Gdol Yisrael who wrote commentaries under the influence or the inspiration to contend with that issue in of itself. And we mentioned the Malbim, and we mentioned Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. In the 19th century,
would you say that the beginning people in those movements were themselves from the same schools as everyone else, and so they were originally from the same level of education and hashkafa, and they made a certain breakaway movement for whatever reason, but the backgrounds were essentially similar?
There were similarities, obviously. You were coming from the same communities, same similar kind of backgrounds. Obviously, there was some similarity. But I think that, at least as far as the Reform movement, I've never studied it thoroughly, so I can't say this, with clear knowledge. But my impression is that in the Reform movement, there was, in other words, there was already a certain shift and reservation from the classic Orthodox way of life that these people had. And therefore, it led to the concept of Reformation. Some of it was in light of impact of the Enlightenment and some of the criticism that the movement in Torah study had on classic Jewish ways of life and Jewish learning. And some of it was an influence of the environment around them, definitely images like Mendelssohn, who had an impact on the thinking. So that I think that on the one hand, yes, they're coming from as a whole community, but it wasn't, one morning we all wake up and we think we can create something different.
No, I thought they might be trying to stem the conversion and assimilation and trying to do what they can to hold the fort in their way of analyzing the problem.
I don't know, it was so much holding the fort. I think it was sort of a more thinking of we've got to move forward to a more enlightened and more educated way of life. In any case, those things challenged the classic Talmudic and scholars in general, which brought about also responses in writing commentaries on Tanakh. At the same period of time, we find also an image I think there are two images that I'll mention here that I assume on some level or another were contending with the same issues, but these things reflect themselves much less in the way they write their commentary, and their commentary has other motivations in it. One is an image that some of you learned with me in the past, the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi of Berlin, who lived from 1816 to 1893, talking about, you know, seriously within that 19th century challenge. The Netziv was a scholar who built himself up through a strong capacity of acute, broad knowledge, and to the extent that there was a period of time he simply literally closed himself in a room and would study on his own, and he therefore had a very broad knowledge base, including Midrashei Halacha, that many others were not as familiar with, books of the sort, which leads him, for example, to write his commentary on the Shi'utot. His commentary to the Torah was an interesting phenomenon. At that period of time, the study of Tanakh as part of the natural curriculum of learning in yeshivot was something that was not really the norm. And there was obviously those who spent time and gave attention to learning some Tanakh, but it was not something that was learned systematically. And I think that that might be true, at least in certain circles, to this day. The Netziv felt that there was an importance in that exposure, and he set up a daily, I think it was a shorter shiur, but a daily shiur in Torah. He followed the order of the Parsha Shavua, but a daily shiur in Torah, Torah Shebichtav, in which he analyzed, discussed the psukim and problems in the psukim and so on. This was done in Shiva, and these shiurim were the basis for his commentary, the Hamek Daber, and its expansion, the Harchev Daber. He makes expanding comments.
You're saying that this was like a novel thing? This was like new idea.
They have a Rosh Yeshiva give, definitely a daily basis. A shiur in Chumash was something extremely novel at the time. Yes. And this, I think, affects in the long run, understanding this affects the understanding of the Pirush. There's a lot of points in the commentary of the Netziv that are either very strongly oriented towards the value of learning Torah, which makes sense when you're presenting this to students in yeshiva and you want to use it also as a base, or the sort, you use the base to encourage and further their commitment and their seriousness in learning. But also, beyond that, there are also a lot of moral aspects. There is a theme that runs from his Akdama, Sefer Bereshit, his famous Akdama to Sefer Bereshit, where he talks about the Avot, the perspective of what they are as human beings, and he connects it all the way through to Sefer Dvarim, where there is this there's a certain recognition of the Kaddish Baruch Hu, as he explains it, on the destroying of the Mikdash Rishon and Mikdash Sheni, and the morality of those aspects as well. He accordingly also gets into issues that I think would fit very much the challenge of young students in yeshiva, where he deals in several places with the question of excessive religious commitment, or going, taking upon yourself things that are extreme and excessive. He speaks about it as far as nedarim, as far as nezirut. In different contexts, he speaks of that. So I think that a lot of the themes and a lot of the ideas that Netziv brings in are affected by the framework in which he is presenting the ideas, and less so the outside world and its Jewish challenges that exist. Now, that's not to say that the Netziv was not involved. The Netziv was involved in broad Jewish leadership. And when he was in the Yeshiva, the isolated town, there are descriptions how students had to come. They would take this long train ride then still have to take a half a day buggy, you know, cart, horse and buggy ride to get to Velazen itself. On the natural train track routes. So it was an isolated town. And when you were there, it enabled you, it gave you certain benefits in many ways, enabled you to close yourself into your own little world. And I think that that is reflected very strongly in the Netziv's Perush on the Torah. Another interesting personality who gives, again, a more, I think, classic approach to his commentary in the sense that the rooting of understanding of Torah for itself and not as a attempt to contend or response to other thoughts is the Meshe Chochma, Meir Simcha HaKohen Mitvins, who lived in, from the years 1843 till 1926. The Meshe Chochma is also, he's the name, the title Meshe Chochma, at least there are those who attempt to explain that the word Meshech is a breakup of his name, Meir Simcha Cohen. Meir Simcha Cohen Mitvins. I don't know if that's the explanation of the name Meshech Chochma, but the Meshech Chochma is Meir Simcha Cohen Mitvins' work on Torah. Interestingly, he actually wrote this Perush when he was about 17 years old. But he never published it. He made sure to publish and become known more for his halachic work and the work that he writes, the Or Sameach, and the Rambam, and so on, becomes the flagship of the association of Meir Simcha HaKohen Mitvitz, and the Perush on Torah is only published either at the end or I think after his death.
We were told that that was a was advice. First, yeah, by the halakhic
work. From his grandfather.
Right.
It was an advice that, from his grandfather that he be known first as a true halakhic Torah scholar. And then, but the point is, it went so far that he actually never bothered publishing. Because he could have, you know, he could have, by the time he was in his mid years, he was already known as a true Torah scholar, and yet it got left and it was put aside. A very unique parish.
Just back into the legend for a minute, was that the only yeshiva of its type at that time?
You're talking about, you're going back to the Netziv?
Yeah.
It was different. In other words, it was afterwards, by the time the Netziv was heading Velazhen, there were already other yeshivot, a similar kind of structure. When Velazhen was established, a unique kind of thing. In other words, in most yeshivot in Europe at that time, there was a system where people would come and learn, and there would be this kind of system. You'd get food from here, get food from that one, and so on. In Velazhen, though they didn't set up a dormitory, but the yeshiva itself rented places for the Talmidim and made agreements with the families where they rented them that they would also, part of their rental would be given a room and food for the Talmidim. In that sense, Velazhen was sort of forerunner to other yeshivot that later founded similar kind of things, and then dormitories came in and so on. But Velazhen also had other differences. Again, that's a study in itself. Velazhen's whole way of learning was different, and it really has a legitimacy in being called Eim HaYeshivot, Mother of all yeshivot. A lot of Torah, a lot of the way of learning was affected from things that went on in Velazhen. But again, I'm putting that aside for now. Right, getting back to Meir Simcha HaKohen Mitvitz and the Mishnah Chochmah, the Mishnah Chochmah has a lot of very unique ideas, but Meir Simcha HaKohen Mitvitz was critical not just of the attitude of reform, which, again, as I said, it's not a central theme in his papers. He was critical also, at least, of the Germanic comfort in Galut. And he came out against this concept that existed then of Berlin being the Yerushalayim Ashkenaz. And he said that Berlin will go down in a storm. And it's not there to last forever. It's not a safe haven for Jews. He said this before the Holocaust. As we mentioned, he himself passed away before the Holocaust. He passed away in 1926. But his understanding of what would happen and how things are playing out, unfortunately, came to fruition.
Well, many people said that. Jabotinsky, I mean, many...
The difference was that these were people who were involved in the Zionist movement and therefore were trying to use this. That was part of their platform. You had to compare it to yourself because by the Meshach HaMahu, by Simcha HaKohen Mitvitz, that wasn't the case. He was not in any way Zionistic. We're in the scene. There are all kind of indications that he was at least cooperative with the Zionist movement. The Meshach HaMahu was not. He wasn't an anti, but he wasn't in any way...
I'm not sure if you had to be in the Zionist movement to get a good reading of life in Eastern Europe. As a result of that reading, you might say to yourself, you're going to leave, but...
Yeah, the most... You see, when you're critical, when you begin with being critical, then it's easier to see the faults. You're part of the system. The organization, making a comment like that is a much more significant aspect. He also, even though, as I said, he wasn't per se Zionistic, he was asked by the JNF, Kakal, to write a letter of support, and he wrote, I'll read the Hebrew, כעת הסבה ההשגחה אשר באספות המלכות, הממלכות, הנאורות, בסנר הרי, ניתן צו אשר ארץ ישראל תהיה לעם ישראל, וכיוון ששר פחד השבועות, okay? He says basically, by the decision of the nations in San Ramay, the limitation of the three שבועות that was a reason to refrain from going to Eretz Yisrael, שר פחד, תחת השבועות, וברישיון המלאכים, כמה מצוות יישוב ארץ ישראל ששקולה כנגד כל מצוות שבתורה למקומה. So the Rabbi spoke about this dream of coming to Eretz Yisrael, working the land, filling mitzvot and zrayim and so on. But here he goes one step further. Not only does he speak about the importance of going to Eretz Yisrael, but he talks about the fact that the or the fact that the nations of the world, the gathering in San Rame, takes away any of the claims against Jews settling in Eretz Yisrael because of the Shalosh Shvuot, something that accompanied a part of the religious debate as far as Zionism for many, many years. And this is worth noting. I want to also note, and with that we'll end. Let's start with one commentary who is not a classic Orthodox Jew. On the contrary, he's a Reform rabbi. Of Dr. Benno Yaakov. Now, not many people know of Benno Yaakov, because most of his works have not been translated from German.
What's his first name?
Was that?
What's his first name?
I think Benno was his first name.
Benno? Uh-huh.
Benno Yaakov.
Uh-huh.
His works he wrote in German. He was a Reform Jew who was opposed to the classic academic direction of the documents that the Tanakh is a collection of documents and an issue of editing earlier and later, and you know, different personalities writing different things. He, even though he wasn't an Orthodox Jew, felt that was not correct, and the Tanakh was a holistic unit. I mentioned him, A, because he does take an interesting stance. Being in the Reform movement, he objects to this idea of the documents. And the other thing is because we find a very significant and important Tanakh scholar who later quotes him often, and that's the Chaim Leibowitz. Chaim Leibowitz, being a committed Orthodox Jew, knowing exactly who this person was, felt that she writes in one of the places, "Lamaditi misfarav yoter ma'asher ma'arbe sfarim shnichtegu al yedei yirei Hashem or yireim." I learned from his books more than I learned from many committed Jews. And she says, "Tanatov shel Yaakov ben Yaakov neged ביקורת המקרא והוכחתיו על פחזנות ושגיאות לא כתב איש דברים טובים מהם." His criticism to the approach of the documents and so on is stronger and more precise and more effective than all kind of other people who wrote their commentaries. So here we have a Reform personality that his writings are in German, so most of the public that has not been exposed. I think I saw somewhere that there was work being done in translating it to English and to Hebrew. But he does get an exposure through the works of Nachum Leibowitz. And anybody who reads Nachum Leibowitz's books will see that time and again she mentions, amongst others, also Benno Yaakov. All right, you know what? We'll stop with that. There were a few other interesting personalities that we could include here, but I think that we've given enough to the Parshanut al HaTorah.
Regarding the Netziv, one last question. His son, Meir Berlin, did he learn from his father? Or was his father too elderly, really, and there's no real connection?
Learned to some extent, but his father passed away when he was relatively young. In other words, his grandfather, Yaakov Shulchan, had probably more effect on Meir Berlin than his father, Netziv. The person who did get, and is a known name, the person who did get a lot from Netziv is Rivera Berlin's oldest brother or half brother, and that is Chaim Berlin. Okay? The person, there's the Shiva in the United States that Chaim Berlin named for him. He was a very, very serious Torah scholar in his own rights, and he did receive a lot from his father at the Netziv. Rivera Berlin did, in places where he refers to him and speaks to him about him, but unfortunately, the Netziv died suddenly, and Meir Berlin was relatively young at the time. So I don't know how much he outright got from him. Okay. An interesting aspect that I think should be related to when speaking about the Achronim and the Achronic literature is the forms of learning of Gemara during the Achronic period. As in everything else, nothing happens, overnight. There is a process, but there are several approaches to learning that are attempted, played with, developed throughout the Achronic period. One of the more well-known had a significant place in the learning of Achronic scholars, but also was strongly criticized throughout the generations, and probably today is seen in almost a negative approach. That is the approach of the pilpul, the pilpul approach. The pilpul approach has an important foundation to it. The pilpul approach, the foundation is that all of the Torah, and specifically all of Shas, is to be seen as one cohesive unit. In other words, the assumption is that you should not encounter any significant contradictions between what find in one Masechet and another Masechet in Shas. Now, this is something that is deeply rooted in the tradition of learning. It actually already appears in the Amoraic learning. In many cases, we find that the Gemara will bring forth a Mishnah and contrast it to a Braita, sometimes another Mishnah, or sometimes two Braitot might be contrasted. In other words, different sources of Tanaic knowledge, and the Gemara is troubled and attempts to answer why are there differences, sometimes outright contradictions, between these different sources. If the Gemara were to see, or if Chazal were to assume, that there are different opinions, different views, there can be contradictions, that easily there are different views, then we would assume that there wouldn't be so much attention and trouble. Okay, this one said this, this one said that. The approach that the Gemara invests into, the idea that the Gemara will only take as a last resort to say that these two Braitot, these two Mishnayot, this Mishnah and Braita are reflecting a machloket, a disagreement, and even then we usually try to connect it to some known machloket, to some known disagreement, and not to try to create some new disagreement, shows that Chazal as a whole saw an importance in viewing the whole halachic realm and the sources, its statements, as one unified and cohesive system.
Is that forced in a way, because things that are written at different centuries and maybe between Bavli and Yerushalmi in different places, maybe they can't be reconciled. And the attempt to reconcile is a forced reconciliation of sorts. I mean, I'm wondering if it's not, as I say, a forced attempt within a sort of an agenda in mind to try to make it seem as if there's one unified system, when in fact there may not be.
The answer to your question, Bruce, lies in the question, in a different question. To what extent do we see Torah, and specifically Torah Shebaal Peh, as some kind of holistic unit that it's, at least its roots, its foundations, are given the Moshe Mitzrayim? And to what extent do we see Torah Shebaal Peh as human creations? And the truth is that there is sort of a balance between the two things, and both things play out. There are certain things that clearly, and there's a direction, certain rules of being Doresh and whatnot, that all reflect some kind of idea of a tradition that goes back to Moshe. And Chazal definitely speak about such an idea. On the other hand, there are takanot, there are all kinds of other activities of Chazal that can be seen more as a human initiative under the circumstances. Now, it could be that circumstances is a human initiative that stems from something. So the more I shift towards a perspective of that Torah Shebaal Peh is rabbinic as humans, then you would be more correct, and the more a person would lean towards or be inclined to say that times make a difference. And
but why not presume that Gemara discussions are in fact rabbinic? So let's pick any topic. We let's say washing hands in the morning. Either I think the Rosh says it's to what hands wander, let's clean them. And there's another perspective of, you know, there's a tumor that settles in the body, and when it leaves a bad tumor.
You're taking all the flashy empty stuff. The secondary, third-rate issues of halacha. I'm talking about the core of Gemara.
No, I'm not talking about those. I'm up to the other areas.
Hands in the morning is not core of Gemara. Half of that, as Rabbi Yosef was against the three times, he said, it's all Kabbalah. It's not Gemara. It's not halacha.
Okay.
It appears in halachic sources, and there is a basis for it, but it's not the core of the halachic discussion. What I'm talking about is I'm talking about structure. Open up a Mishnah and then go through the Gemara. Okay? In many cases, again, it varies from Mishnah. It says you have to wait a while to.
The Gemara is a lot more than that. That's what I'm suggesting.
But you will find in many cases that Mishnah itself is contrasted to other Breitot, or different Breitot are brought and contrasted to each other. In other words, Chazal in the Amoraic period felt that there had to be some kind of guiding perspective, at least a guiding perspective, that would lead to the conclusions as a whole in the same direction. But that doesn't mean there aren't machlok throughout, that there are machlok, but the machlokot are meant to be, the attempt of Chazal is to limit the machlokot and leave them in core issues, and not take a direction, oh, this is just this one's view, and that's this one's view, and so on. That is not the way Chazal saw it. I think it stems from the idea that the belief that is inherent in Orthodox Jewry is the Torah Shebaal Peh is part of what was given to Am Yisrael at Har Sinai. And therefore, at least, there has to be a cohesive core. That cohesive core, if it falls apart, loses the influence, the impact of the halachic system. The truth is, there were machlokot. And throughout the generations, machlokot were sort of became more common. But even then, you can always see that the machloket stems from a question of understanding a particular point that is common and how we're to take it further. So that an inherent part of the learning was some kind of cohesiveness. It didn't receive, definitely after the Amoraic period, it didn't receive a strong expression until the Baalei HaTosfot. Mentioned when we spoke about the Rishonic commentaries, the Gaonic commentaries, they're very localized. They explain, they try to understand the depth of a particular sugya, a difficult discussion in a particular place in the Gemara, but they don't contrast it, they don't compare it to other places in Shas. The Baalei HaTosfot are the ones who opened the door in the sense of looking at similar discussions throughout Shas, knowing potential differences, and attempting to answer and resolve those seeming differences and contrast, or trying to create a cohesive picture, including those differences. Therefore, there are those who associate the pilpul system to Baalei HaTosfot. I think that's not correct, and you'll understand that in a minute. I think that's not correct. What is correct is that the core idea, looking at the broad picture of Shas, taking different sources and comparing them and dealing with differences that appear in the different places, that does come from the Baalei HaTosfot. But the pilpul system, which was is seen at least to have been formulated and started primarily by a great Torah scholar, Rav Yaakov Pollak, one of the early Polish Torah scholars. He was a Rosh Yeshiva in Krakow. He was also interestingly known for a dispute that he had with a lot of the Gedolei Torah in his generation, when he allowed for his, I think his niece was, to do miyu. She was married off at a very young age, and he allowed her to be mamayim, to refuse the marriage when she became older, and to the extent he also allowed her to marry somebody else. And that became a very, very strong dispute between him and other Torah scholars in his time. And his willingness to stand by it, in spite of the fact that all these people spoke against him, teaches his solidness and his well-established Torah place within Torah leadership. He developed the pilpul direction. As I said, the idea of the pilpul direction fundamentally is to find or note differences, contradictions, questionable relations between different places in the Gemara or different parts of the Gemara, and try to resolve the difference. But between what Rav Yaakov Pollak and his Talmid afterwards, Shalom Shachne, their Talmidim, what they attempted to do to what the Baalei HaTosfot did is in its association to the halachic conclusion or the halachic realm and its purpose. Baalei HaTosfot used this idea of looking at the broad picture of Shas, bringing in different sugyo, and trying to resolve or build a picture from the different sources, do it with a very strong awareness of molding and formulating the halachic world. World in the broad sense, not necessarily always halacha lemaisa, though the Baalei HaTosfot don't hesitate to lead to statements of practical halachic conclusion. At the time of the Achroni, beginning with Rabbi Yaakov Pollak and his Talmid Rabbi Shalom Shachna, here the system was used not for the purpose of developing a halachic perspective, but rather for the purpose of sharpening the mind and bringing interesting intellectual perspectives on Torah study. In other words, it was intellectualism for the sake of intellectuals, and had no, at least necessary or intent, of leading to halachic understanding. And this is the core of what led to major criticism on this approach of learning, because the feeling was the Sefer Devar, the Gemara, was a halachic work in its broad sense. Not the halacha, the maisa that tells exactly what to do, but halachic as far as molding the world of halacha, its thinking, its values, and therefore its directions that it gives you in the long run, how to behave and how to behave. When you take that out, when you learn it just as something that enables the sharpness of understanding, then you've basically emptied the Gemara from its practical, pragmatic place as a guideline to the Jewish life. That was the primary criticism of the Purple Movement, but there were many Torah scholars that learned that way. And that also includes Torah scholars who interacted in the halachic world. It's simply there was some kind of split in their learning. There was the analytical world of analysis of the Gemara, which was an intellectual exercise in itself. And there was the Gemara as it leads in many different ways to halachic conclusions. In their own learning, these were two different worlds. To the extent that there were literally get-togethers in the pupil world, there were literal get-togethers in which presentations of ideas were presented just to show the sharpness, the gadlut of Torah, hagdil Torah la'atkan, in the sense of show how bright and how sharp Torah is and what we can do with it as far as the sharpness of learning. So that was a significant movement of study in the Achronic period. Interestingly, at least the two initial and early proponents of this movement, Yaakov Pollack and Reb Shalom Shachna, did not write their Chiddushim. Very, very little from them in a literary form. I think it's Reb Shalom Shachna, I think that what they did was made comments in his Gemara. We're talking about the Achronic period, he already had a printed Gemara, and he wrote for himself notes and comments. But those notes and comments were printed later on. Edited, I think, a little bit and printed later on. But that's it. And I think, again, it's not an absolute thing, but I have this feeling that this was not coincidental, and that the nature of the pupil thinking is something that leans towards not writing. Because when you write something, you publish something, it's something that you see as a value for future generations. When the idea is what sharp point I can come up with, okay, so it's to sharpen my mind, to challenge my students, doesn't have necessarily any significant meaning or message to future generations. I believe that that may have affected the amount that was printed, though there are later scholars who learned in this manner and did print their commentaries. Another or a parallel approach that existed and really reflected to some extent the opposition to the people movement was the approach that learned the Gemara in its focusing mostly on the page, on the text that was being learned at the time that was before you, and its leaning towards halacha. In other words, the sources that were learned with it, the Rishonim that were learned with it, and so on, were, in the other extreme, a bend towards halachic consequence, halachic significance. The analytical aspect of it was minimal to a great extent. The bekiyut aspect, the knowledge, was more important, and the halachic conclusions that it led to. And these two approaches were maybe two ends and extremes, each with its strengths and faults. In other words, the pupil movement definitely developed a capability of thought analysis, the capability of coming up with ideas that I'm sure served the same Torah scholars when they had to deal with novel questions in resolving those questions. That same sharpness, that same developed thinking when trying to resolve halachic problems. On the other hand, the other approach,
What years were that started, would you say?
It begins with Yaakov Pollack is, remember the second, let's see if I can find you the exact years that he lived, but it was...
Oh, this is the century.
Was that?
What century is it in?
It would be the, approximately the end of the 15th, 14th, the 16th century. It's the beginning of the, Chronic period.
Could Hasidism have some reaction against that? People that couldn't learn or didn't learn had no yeshiva background, or could this have widened that schism?
Hasidism comes in later.
No, but I'm gonna maybe as a result, perhaps, or
okay. So Hasidism comes in later, right? As the pupil movement, the pupil learning precedes Hasidut by quite a few years. Going about a few hundred years. There is an impact, an effect of the presence of the pupil movement and also some of its counter movements that brings about the Hasidic, or part of the effect of the Hasidic movement. In other words, the ability to be part of the pupil movement really meant that you had to be seriously intelligent and have the time to delve into such deep analytical thinking. The average Jew who was working hard to just maintain himself would have a hard time associating, appreciating the pupil learning. And that is part of what accompanied the Hasidic movement, which was meant to be this more popular, this more movement that answers the need of the average person. In that sense, later on, the presence of the pupil movement aggravates things that is part of what brings about the Hasidic movement. But the Hasidic movement as such did not, best of my knowledge, the Hasidic movement as such did not in any way develop a unique or special approach to learning, learning the whole Torah Shabbat range of sources. it basically rejected the difficulty of the pupil movement and some of the other in-depth studies, and therefore most of the Hasidic movement embraced more the approach of a bekiyut kind of learning with a accompanying it halacha lemaisa aspects of what should be done. Then it had its other aspects of Hasidic aspects and so on that accompanied it. That's not to say that there weren't Hasidic rabbeim who did delve into serious in-depth learning of Gemara. Right? There were those who were, we have from them some very serious Torah works. Okay. In any case, we're sort of running out of time here, so let's summarize at least what we saw in this stage, and we'll continue with it next week. We have two sort of parallel paths of learning earlier period of the Rumi. One is the pupil movement started by Rav Yaakov Polak and his Talmud Yerushalmi Shachna, which focuses on analysis, takes the breath of Shas basis to create analysis for its own sake. Part of what that system had was something was called the Shita Chiluki. It's creating Chiluki. Chiluki means distinctions. Now, this concept of Chilukim is later used in a more practical manner by other analytical systems. But the idea of Chiluk is, I have this and I have this. They seem to differ. No, they make a distinction. This is this way because of A, and that's that way because of B. And therefore, I resolve the problem. This is a very simplistic presentation, but that's the idea of Chilukim. That's part of the thinking, the analytical thinking of the Pilpul movement. Alongside of it, there were those who learned more in the sense of a halachic perspective. In other words, the Gemara was learned to understanding and the knowledge of the Gemara, looking for its halachic messages, and then moving on to halachic works throughout the generations, leading to their time to be able to understand the halachic world in a better way. Those were two parallel movements that ran more or less throughout the Achronic period. The latter half, the latter part of the Achronic period brings forward, as some extent, a response to the Pilpul movement, brings forward other ways of learning analytically, which were not this abstract for the academic purpose in itself of the Pilpul movement and random discussions here and there, but things that try to create something more systematic that we will deal with in Yirtzeh Hashem next week.
Just one quick question. When we say that the Svardim created codes and like the Rambam, the various halakhic codes, and the Ashkenazim seem to focus on commentaries, which seems less practical per se.
I don't think that's accurate.
Well, that was my question, whether...
I don't think that's accurate. In other words, the Rambam wrote a codification. Okay? But what about the Rambam? Rashba? The Ritva? The Ra? There's so many other Sephardic in the Rishonic period. Sephardic scholars that didn't do that, to make that, take the Rambam and decide that's the system of the Sephardim, I think would be somewhat misleading. And more than that, I think if you want
the Rif, the Rif filters out
everything other than what we need to do. But the Rif did not codify, and what the Rif did, a lot of other scholars did also. The Rif takes the sugya and brings out those aspects that he feels are of importance, are necessary for the halachic faith. But the codification is what Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, and maybe afterwards extended by Ravina Ravashi, but it's not a unique codification.
Right. Because those other Sfarim you mentioned are in the northeast section of Spain, very effective from Provence, which really would be Ashkenaz. So it's, I'm just wondering if their learning style is more.
I said, we talked about the Rishonim. I said it was cross influence. Any question? Some of it is personal, some of it is cross influence. But to come in and generalize the Sfaradic learning of definitely the Rishonic Sfaradic learning. Because of the Rambam, or even if you want to associate in our Yaakov Balaturim, the son of the Rosh, the Ashkenazic Sfaradic, even if you associate it, because he, after all, as a whole, grew up and lived in Spain, so even if you want to associate him with Sfaradic, so you find two images of this sort, but you have many other Sfaradic scholars who don't do that, I think that is...
You can't say, therefore, that the halakhic bottom line was a more Sfaradic approach, as opposed to Topol, which is an Ashkenazi approach.
No.
Okay.
And definitely the Rishonic period. Right? Let's Rishonic period, I would not agree with that. To the extent that, on the contrary, in the Sephardic world, there's some kind of schism or some separation between works that are more halachic and works that are more analytical. There you find the Chidushim of the Ramban, the Chidushim of the Rashba, and so on. Rarely will a statement of halacha lemaisa with a Bali HaTosfot, and even Chachmei Ashkenaz, their combinations, Chachmei Ashkenaz deal mostly in halacha, and therefore. In the Achronic period, because the Pilpul movement and so on, there's more truth to that, especially since the Sephardic learning system was more halachic, that we'll discuss next time. So there you already find some kind of distinction, but that distinction is not necessarily Sephardic and Ashkenazic. It appears within the Ashkenazic world as well.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
We'll stop today and have a great day.
Hope the snow will melt. Have a great Shabbat.